fancy way of saying that it has a Doppler detector. It's got a range Doppler matrix, RDM, I think they call it. It's got a range Doppler matrix inside. What that really is an electronic circuit that does the equivalent of creating a spreadsheet. The spreadsheet has got a whole lot of squares on it. Horizontally is time delay. Vertically is frequency delta to the nearest 10 or 20 hertz, some very small number. And so your particular target, if you're looking at an airplane in front of you, say for instance you're tracking an airplane and you're flying 5 miles behind this airplane and you and I are flying at similar velocity.
Shift,
I sound echo. Aircraft is directly below you, and you're flying at now there's zero Doppler shift between you and that aircraft. You've got range difference. So there you've got a range difference definition, because you know that the ground clutter is going to be some number of miles below the aircraft that you're tracking. So again, the magic of the range Doppler matrix allows you to differentiate to a... It allows you to... range and... in azimuth, which means now the rate at which the ground clutter Doppler is changing. In other words, you get the maximum Doppler straightforward. The Doppler center is aimed at match the Doppler matrix. Very complicated display.
Shall we look up in
Venus?
Ohms each.
disadvantage.
Giving up signal strength in order to get a good impedance match and/or
isolation. You can make a lossless power divider when you do it with inductive and transmission line circuits. That's the good news. The bad news is they tend to be very frequency sensitive.
Type with the 61. just happened one to me. KC2WGB.
I agree with you.
quick calculation on that star system. It comes up with roughly around 27 ohms, something like that. Does that sound right to you?
Okay, very good. three different topics. You know, you've got the SpaceX going up.
Comments, WS2M, K2LAW.
Okay, very good. three main topics. Flight to the International Space Station by the Russian.
Oh, wow.
This month on the 23rd. Curiosity doing good. Going to be using the SAM equipment. Because they know they're in the... And the third topic would be the Dragon.
Was
last time in May and bought up maybe 700 pounds of stuff or half a ton, but now they're bringing up a lot more. Now that it's an actual contracted flight, $1.5 billion over the next 3 or 4 years of these flights going up by Dragon. Now, these are reusable spacecraft. You know, not only does it land in the water, they refurbish it and shoot it back up again. At least 10 flights per craft is the way it's designed.
Fantastic. Okay, Soyuz, I think you said, is going up on October 23rd. What's the date that Dragon is going up or coming back? Over to you, Paul.
And that goes up next Sunday, October 7th. I believe it was the 7th. I don't have my calendar here. But, you know, during that time, nighttime, Eastern Standard Time, 8:30 or something. But, that's being launched from Cape Canaveral on a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket and spacecraft are designed and built by SpaceX. So they're way ahead of the game. I wanted to comment about the water. They've landed two flights in the water so far, and they're within, 15 minutes of picking them up. They go right on target. They have their own ship to pick these things up. SpaceX has their own recovery vehicles. And then future flights, I'm not sure how many down the road, they'll be sending these things back and they'll be landing on land. Parachutes come down, retro rockets fire at the end, a couple of big cushions come out, and these things will be landing on solid surface maybe a year or two from now.
I half expected you to tell me it's going to land with a space crane, similar to Curiosity, the Mars Science Laboratory. Well done.
Wow.
SpaceX, Dragon, fired up there by Falcon 9. That's going to take... That factory, that company, are they California-based, Paul? WS2M, K2LIW?
Yeah, their mission control is Hawthorne, California, It's funny watching that. They've got all the panels. I mean, it looks like a mission control. And that's where they operate out of. That's the headquarters for now. Very well organized. I saw some of the building of it that was going on a documentary on getting these rockets ready in for the launch pads and all. They took off at Complex 40. NASA is allowing them the use of that facility, but they did a lot of their own infrastructure and things, for the Falcon 9 rockets to be launched. So, I mean, they're doing everything from soup to nuts, arranging the infrastructure for the launches of the Falcon 9, itself, the spacecraft, the cargo spacecraft, which is going to serve as a dual purpose. Given about 4 or 5 years from now, they're going to be launching people in this Dragon spacecraft. They've signed a couple of contracts, private contracts with different companies now to put their satellites up in space. They've actually signed a couple of contracts. I think the first one will be next year. Dragon will be launched in spacecraft. Some kind of spacecraft will be put up there by private corporations using a private corporation, SpaceX. Back to you, Dick.
My goodness, is that well done. Paul, do you have a rough guess as to the number of pounds of payload that Dragon can bring into orbit or back down? And give me a rough guess as to what that is compared to Space Shuttle. Space Shuttle, we got a rough guy idea of how many pounds of hardware it can launch. I think the absolute maximum was the Hubble Space Telescope. But is Dragon a good fraction of that amount of launch capability? WS2N, K2LIW?
I forget how heavy the Hubble was. Yeah, I think that was the heaviest thing. I forgot the payload. Well, look at the shuttle itself. I think that was 250,000 pounds. So it would go up and come back. bring up cargo. Last time it was demonstration flight. I think a half ton. this is a little over a ton up and about 700 back. And their capabilities, I believe, I remember reading 6,000 pounds, eventually. That's what they'll be able to do. You know, they can load up the inside, and then they've got, at the back, they've got what they call like a trunk area, where there's, you know, if certain things are going up to the space station, they're going to be put on the outside of the space station. They don't have to be, you know, pressurized in the atmosphere. They have like a trunk area, so I mean, collectively, I think it's a 6,000 pound payload. So if you bring people up, and you know, you got them out minus the weight, they'll be able to, in the astronaut configuration, they'll be able to put a maximum of 7 people in. You know, if you look at the layout, you'll see 3 up front and 4 in the back. That'll be the layout of the launch facility. I mean, originally I thought it was going to be, you know, like all around one big ring, but it's not. It's going to be like 3 and then, you know, like an upper deck and lower deck. They got big plans. Like I said, they're doing good. I mean, Bigelow's doing good. Let me drop it. It's a private company. They want to put the space tab up there and actually make like a small space station, a bunch of these blow-up facilities. They're going to connect them, and they'll be quite large. So they'll have the Bigelow space station, and they'll be launched. In fact, I think they're contracted with SpaceX to put their space heads up there. You've got a couple of other ones, Sierra, Nevada, I think that's the name of the company. They've got the Dream Chaser. They're going to launch that maybe in a couple of years. That looks like a small space shuttle, very small space shuttle. I mean, you can put 7 people on board. But I mean, these things are ongoing contracts that NASA's signed with. So it looks good for a commercial space flight in the future, Dick.
Yeah, I'm impressed. Since Dragon is a California company, at first you think they would like to try to launch from California. But I'm getting the impression that all launches are taking from Cape Canaveral, Florida, Titusville area. So does Dragon generate all their hardware in Florida, or do they produce their hardware in California and ship it to Florida? When you're talking about things this large, shipping is very difficult. So how do they handle that stuff, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
The Falcons, I think, are being manufactured in Texas. I forgot where the Dragons are being worked on, probably California. One of the private missions that they did sign will take off out of Vandenberg Air Force Base. I think it might be for military satellite built by a private corporation. I'll have to review that one. But they definitely have plans of launching out of California as well.
So I think you're saying they're going to launch out of California eventually, but all of the present launches, even with difficult shipping, I mean, Falcon had to be produced in Texas, but Texas... if it was near the coast, you could ship it over water over to Florida. But the rest of the hardware that was made in California, if the current launches were done from Florida, I think you're telling me that hardware had to be shipped to Florida in order to get launched. Is that your best guess on that one, Paul? KQ Alexander.
Hey, Dick, all normal.
Yeah, oh yeah, that's what they're doing. And eventually the Falcon 9 launch vehicle will be reusable. I mean, they have plans of reusing all this stuff. So, I mean, down the road, you go to their website, you know, they show initial Falcon 9, which basically have 9 engines on board, eventually returning to Earth. And then they have the upper stage. Spacecraft actually coming back with parachutes.
spacecraft, which serves as a dual purpose. They will land the spacecraft, and they'll have airbags come out at the end too, but there'll be rockets that will slow it down, and then it will land on the ground. The other purpose is it could be used for emergencies. When you take off anywhere during the flight, we drop it. But there's two different designs that have been pushed over the last, I don't know how many decades. You've got the Mercury, Saturn, Apollo designs where you had, they call them tractor motors or tractor rockets. What looks like an antenna tower, you know, attached to the top of these spacecraft. At the top of the antenna tower, truss-looking setup, are these rockets and solid booster rockets, which fire and pull the spacecraft away from the rocket, the main rocket, the Saturn V, or the Redstone rocket in case of Mercury, or the Apollo missions would pull the spacecraft away in kind of emergency. Then you've got the pusher style. That's the latest design. We drop it. The pusher style rockets for emergencies, you know, it looks like it's a nice contour with the shape of the, I'm going to call it the capsule. And you really can't even tell that they're there unless you look close and you can see the ports. So what happens is if there's an emergency, these things, rockets will fire and push the spacecraft away from the rocket. And at any point, either on the launch pad or, you know, even if they're, you know, halfway up into space, even beyond that, you know, almost into orbit, you could push them away, where the tractor type can't do that. You know, the tractor type, you get up to a certain area, and that separates anyway. That goes bye-bye. And then the spacecraft goes into orbit. The pusher type is better because it stays with the spacecraft. So let's say there's no emergency. They've got all this fuel on board. When it comes back to Earth, they'll go through the parachute, you know, they'll go through the heat shield, the parachute, and when they get close to the ground, they'll have these rockets fire to actually land them on the ground. So I think it's a much better system. A couple of the companies that are making it, including Boeing, Boeing's involved with this. Boeing looks, it kind of looks like the Dragon spacecraft. Very similar design, about the same size, maybe a little bit bigger. And that's also going to carry 7 astronauts on board. But they're doing pretty good, heavily involved. I think they call it the CST-100. You put that on the computer. I don't know, they might be a year or two away from their first launch, which would be, up to the space station. So a lot of companies involved, and that's the latest on Dragon.
You know, I'm kind of amazed by all of this stuff, Paul. What I'm amazed by is that the general public, and I'm part of that, has rather little knowledge of these systems. Let me, I get rid of the extra hum, the extra hissing sound. Rather little knowledge of it. From the general public's point of view, NASA used to have something called the Space Shuttle, and we abandoned the Space Shuttle, and the only backup we've got is the Russian Soyuz, to put our astronauts into orbit. In reality, there's a whole lot of other American companies, American/European companies, in the process of producing space hardware that's going to be launching equipment, people, and whatever, bringing it up and back down. So there was a lot going on behind the scenes that we didn't seem to know about. It looks like our media hasn't given much coverage, or we haven't sorted out. You get the same impression I do, that the average guy on the street thought there was nothing but shuttle or Soyuz, and the reality is a hell of a lot of other things in the wings that's going to be doing all of this space effort. WS2N, K2RIW.
WS Glenn Friday. The impression I got over the last, I don't know how many decades, you know, you go to work and you tell somebody about the space shuttle, and they're bringing up another space lab, you know, or a space lab, and you've got 7 astronauts floating around in the back of the cargo bay, you know, in the space.
you know, the answers you would get, oh, they're sending another one up, you know. I mean, they didn't know these things were going up. They didn't know they were coming down. Maybe what they heard was Challenger explosions and disasters, and Columbia, you know, in 2003 blowing up. You know, oh, yeah, we know all about that. Or the failure of the Hubble spacecraft, I remember hearing that. Well, it turned out to be the biggest. I mean, the telescope turned out to be probably the biggest success ever. By the way, there's another deep field picture I saw on the internet. In fact, they showed a difference. They showed a picture of the moon and then the actual deep field, the relationship to the moon. It's about the size of a small crater on the moon. That's the angle of the width of this deep field picture. Wanted to bring that up too. I forgot about that. But that's the impression I get. You've got to look for this stuff to find. I found it in magazines and mostly, of course, now the internet. It's not that. Remember all the early flights, young man flights and man flights. It was 24 hours on TV when I was younger. You don't see that thing.
Yeah, things have changed. I'm glad you brought that up. Step by way, do a quick experiment here. I thought of going back to the normal method, and maybe I can't. Let me go back to the way I was. Okay, the Hubble. Oh, about 8 or so years ago, the group in Maryland that controls the Hubble took some of their own time, 1 million seconds of their own time, and
sorry, Dick, I thought maybe he was gone.
Green deep field was not 1 million seconds, but 2 million seconds, and it's a small little picture. By that I mean the extreme deep field is roughly, I pasted it off on the picture, so to speak, compared it to the moon, and it's roughly 2 minutes of arc, horizontally and vertically, which is 1/30th of a degree. 1/30th of a degree, horizontally and vertically. The moon is half a degree. So it's a very small fraction of the moon, just like Paul said, like the size of a crater. In that tiny little space, with the newer cameras they got on board with the Hubble, let me drop. They integrate that picture for 2 million seconds, which is something like, I think it's almost 15 or 20 days worth. Not done all at once, done in various times that they had time left over, and put it all together. And in that picture is many thousands of galaxies that have never been seen before. There was a beautiful presentation that included that, among other subjects, at Suffolk Community College, the Selden campus, at the Smithtown Science Building last Friday night, 2 nights ago. There was this astronomy lecture that I attended, very well done, in which they talk about what does that picture show you. And the deepest object, the most distant object mankind has ever photographed is in that extremely deep field picture that was just released by NASA this week. And that object is 40 billion light years away. And the first question I asked is, whoa, wait a minute now. The Big Bang was 13.7 billion years ago. We think the radius of the observable universe is 13.7 billion years. And in that picture, there is something that is 40 billion years old. And as I told the professor, the mathematics is a little bit, Professor Angus, I think his name is, that mathematics is a little bit spooky. Let me drop. To which he says, yes, it does sound that way, but you have to realize that the universe has been expanding continuously since the Big Bang. And that partial, in his mind, that explains it. I still got some questions as to how you can take a picture of something that is 40 billion years, light years away from us. And was that part of another universe? Was that part of our universe?
and our universe, we think, is 13.7 billion years old. But, as I've said many times, you give me a big enough telescope in space, you aim it in some particular direction that you think has got nothing, you integrate the picture long enough, you gather enough photons, you're going to see things you've never seen before. I believe that extremely deep field picture contains something close to 5,000 galaxies, most of which have never been seen before. It makes you feel a little bit small. And the lecture did include quite a bit of information about the current thinking, and that is, was there only one Big Bang? Is there only one universe, and we just happen to be in the center of it? As I said during my little question and answer, I think we're about to be humbled again. We used to think we're the center of the solar system. We're not. We used to think we're the center of the galaxy. We're not. We used to think we're the center of the galactic group. We're not. We used to think we're the center of the universe. We're not. And now we're going to think we're in the center of the multiple universes. If you've got a object in there 40 billion light years away or old, I'm not sure which it is that part of this universe, or is it the adjacent universe? And once again, I ask that question, hey, the outer stuff on our universe is not only expanding, but it is accelerating in expansion. And so they try to use this word dark energy to explain that. It's got some kind of push energy to it, and that's a hard one to believe. I think the stuff is being sucked over the hill to the mass centers of all the other universes outside of our observable universe. I asked that question, and the professor said, I don't know. I said, is it possible? He says, maybe. What do you put any comments on it? But I guess you've seen this extreme deep field. I presume there's some place where we can go and buy a nice color print of that. What do you think, Paul? And we could download it if you've got a real good color printer. WS2M, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I would just download it. I guess you could send away for anything, Dick. Yeah, I saw 5,000 galaxies, they said. So I agree with that. And, yeah, 13.7 billion years old, but you know, that puts us, what, like 28? You would think 28 billion for a diameter, you know, if everything was a big sphere. But they're really talking about age, 13.7 billion years old. That's the way I looked at it, but the universe itself is much bigger than that. And I've heard it's at least 40 billion light years across. I've read that. There's a fellow, I think you know his name, Green. He's a physicist, cosmologist, the whole bit. He's got a book about hidden reality, and I've been reading that. He tries to explain that. I'll have to reread that chapter. Maybe I'll go back to you next week or something. But he tries to explain that whole paradox with the 13.7 and 40 billion light year controversy that it is in his book, Hidden Reality, I think it's called. And I heard John wanted to question it too. Back to you, Dick.
Go right ahead, John.
KC2WTV. It's for Paul. Paul, my question is on the consumables on board the spacecraft where they have six astronauts. Basically, the oxygen and the water supply. Do they have to bring up supplemental on either one of those, or can they recycle enough water? And how is that done? Evaporates or reverse osmosis, if you know. And the oxygen, also the scrubbers, do it all. That's basically my question. KC2WTV. Back to you, Dick.
You've got a Paul?
Well, on any of the spacecraft that go up, they have their own scrubbers and things like that. But, you know, the shuttle had it, Soyuz has it, and eventually the manned Dragon missions will have it, and the Dream Chasers, they'll have it. They'll have the enough consumables to get them there, and actually eventually to get them back. Don't forget, these things will dock with the space station and stay there for 6 months at a time. On average, they've got to be able to stay fueled and plenty of power and everything ready for an emergency. Flight rules are, however many people are on board the space station, you need as many seats to get off. That thing, you know, gets hit with a meteor. Everybody has to abandon the space station if there's a fire. You need, you know, you can't say, well, we're missing. we got to leave somebody behind. We don't have enough seats. So everybody has their own seat. So that means these things are equipped and ready to go. Now, it's usually a two-day flight to the space station, and it's usually about 5 hours back. You know, when the Soyuz separates from the space station, I mean, they're back in no time. So you could eat breakfast on the International Space Station, and you can have lunch when you get back in Kazakhstan. No problem there for consumables. Yeah, but going up, they need a couple of days. And they will. Right now, of course, it's three on board, and eventually you'll be able to carry up to seven astronauts. Don't see any reason to have that, but, I mean, they're going to have that capability by all these private companies. Boeing will have it. Dragon X will have it, and Sierra Nevada for the Dream Chaser. Back to you, John.
Let me answer that, what John is asking, and that is, each breath you and I take, Paul, is roughly 1 liter of air, rough volume. And so the number of liters of air we breathe per day is a pretty big number. And even if you can compress it, it's going to fill up your house in a year. So when it comes to fluids coming out of a human being, I'm pretty sure you've told us that a certain amount of that can be recycled. But when it comes to the carbon dioxide that humans breathe out, we breathe in oxygen, and we get energy out of the oxygen by converting it to carbon dioxide, is one way of looking at it very simplistically. And the carbon dioxide comes out, and I think that is filtered out with lithium hydroxide filters. And to my knowledge, the filters hold on to the carbon dioxide. That's the good news. But I don't know of those filters being recycled. I think that oxygen is gone. So is there a way of recycling the carbon dioxide back into oxygen that you know about? And that would really make this space station a lot more self-sustainable. WS2M, K2LIW.
Now, I know they have the lithium hydroxide. They've had them for years. Russia had their own version of them. They've got some kind of heat behind that. I always thought that was on the dangerous side, some kind of a glowing coil or something. These things are used as they scrub the carbon dioxide out of the spacecraft, but what happens to it? Does it get separated again? I don't know chemically if they do that. I don't know. I know they're always constantly bringing up oxygen with them. All of the different flights, you know, they always say they're bringing up a couple, 100 pounds or 1,000 pounds of water. Well, they're also bringing up, many hundreds of thousands of pounds of liquid oxygen every time they go up. So, don't know. We'll have to research whether or not they're actually separating the carbon dioxide and dumping the carbon and reusing the oxygen. Don't ring a bell. Back to you, there.
You just said another very interesting set of words there, Paul. I've never even considered the mechanism, the form in which the oxygen is brought up. Lots of oxygen's got to be brought up because I think the process of selecting, of separating the carbon dioxide that has been scrubbed from the atmosphere, the exhaust from the human beings. The carbon dioxide is scrubbed by way of these lithium hydroxide filters, and I think the carbon dioxide molecules stick to the elements of the filter. And when it comes to getting it back out, separating the oxygen from the carbon, I think that's difficult. I don't know if that can be done on board. But the oxygen they brought up, you said the word liquid. I always assumed that from now they bring up a bunch of compressed oxygen cylinders, and you said they bring up liquid oxygen. Did they bring up a great big tank full of liquid oxygen that's continuously boiling off, cryogenically cooled, and that somewhere gets stored on the International Space Station? And my goodness, does that have explosion capabilities if things are not done just right? Just a few words on that one, Paul. WS2M, K2LIW.
Yeah, they bring up liquid oxygen, liquid helium, for that, there's a lot of, there are thrusters and things like that on board the space station, so they've got the fuel in there, common fuel, hydrazine, all over the place, and they need to pressurize the hydrogen hydrogen. They use a lot of times they use helium, or they'll use nitrogen to pressurize that so that, you know, the fuel gets pushed into the, you know, where it's got to go. You know, they've got pumps and things like that, but I mean, they do have a lot of helium and nitrogen on board. Gigantic tanks of oxygen have been brought up by the space shuttle and attached to the outside of the space station. Many, many tanks. And liquid oxygen, 3,200 pounds of pressure inside these things. You look at all the piping on the International Space Station and all the power cables, and data cables, tanks, everything bolted to the outside of the space station, pumps, drop it. Ammonia tanks, things like that. Everything is attached to the outside of the space station. All the piping, every time they do spacewalks, they're getting ready for another module. They're always extending the or reconnecting ammonia lines and oxygen lines. All the infrastructure is on the outside. That's why when you look at the inside of the space station, everything looks open and clear. You know, you go from one end to the other. It looks like big square rooms as you flow through. Mir spacecraft was opposite there, the plumbing and all the tanks, oxygen tanks, everything on the inside of the space station. And, you know, you took off from one end to the other, it looked like a nightmare. It looked like we just barely fit to get from one side to the other space station. Every door is at least a meter in diameter. Some of them are big, square-looking doors. If you look at the opening of the Dragon spacecraft when that thing was first opened, it looks bigger than a meter. This big door just slides to the side. All these tanks, 3,000-pound pressure things, are attached to the outside of the space station there.
Considering that liquid oxygen in that tank at 3,200 pounds of pressure has the ingredients there sitting at, let me pick a number, 30 degrees Kelvin minus some ridiculous number of degrees centigrade, cryogenically cooled in liquid form under high pressure, as it slowly warms up, it's continuously boiling off. Hopefully you're boiling it off at a rate at which you use it, but if not, there's got to be an escape valve somewhere to make sure the tank doesn't overpressurize. If that escape valve should freeze up and jam, then in theory the tank could explode. Because the tank is on the outside of the station, in theory that sounds to me like a survivable situation. So